when I listen, I find out what's going on. I find out the issues of the day. I find out about different people's personalities and the DJs and broadcasters and their styles. It's such an eclectic mix and such an important part of the community that I deeply value KPFT. It's been maybe the most important station to me in my career and journey. I'm really grateful to you guys for existing and doing what you do.
Hayes Carl. Listen for his music and other local artists here on KPFT.
Hi there. I'm Luba Dvorak, singer-songwriter here in Houston, Texas. You're listening to KPFT Houston.
Hey, it is 6 p.m. Wednesday. It is time for So What's Your Story? The only show in Houston devoted to storytelling, and you're going to find it only here on KPFT 90.1 on the dial or kpft.org online. I am your host, Hank Rubicek, and every week, along with the best team on radio, we bring you ordinary people telling pretty extraordinary stories. And thanks to you, we've been doing it since 2008. Over 700 storytellers, your neighbors, our students, seasoned Texas tellers, astonishing tellers from around the globe delivering stories about every theme, emotion, and human experience. Now, I tell you this because, as you know, we are in our fund drive, and we do want to put the fun in fund. You've heard that before, I know. But remember, we are listener-sponsored, and that means without you, we don't stay on the air. The kind of eclectic programming that really does mirror and reflect this fantastic community means that this station is your station. KPFT is Houston's community station, and we need you to give us a call at 713-526-5738, jam KPFT, or go to kpft.org and give us your generous donations. I'm asking kindly. You know why? Because you've been kind enough to keep us on the air. And don't leave it up to the other guy. You know it doesn't work that way, right? Now, tonight, Chris Gorman and Harwood Taylor are fixtures in our storytelling community, and they're great friends, and I'm so glad they're here. They are early guest tellers on this show, helping to set the scene for Houston's telling and the bar for excellence. Moth champions several times over, story coaches, and folks that I am very proud to call my friends. Chris is a veteran pharmacy technician, and Harwood is the director of Elio Art Gallery. Additionally, Chris and Harwood are former co-hosts on this show and did nothing short of strengthening our following with a list of great guests of their own. You guys, thank you so much for being here. I know we've said it before, but thank you for being here.
Thank right? you for having
Chris,
us.
Chris, I know you live for this, right?
Oh, yeah. Anything I'm doing then when I'm not working, I'm in.
I love my work, too, but yes.
Yeah,
I
like and Howard, you used to be, we used to talk about Gremillion, and
that's
now
right.
You're at Elio. Tell us where that is.
So we are in the old Stages Theater building. We're just we're half a block away from the new Stages Theater, which is also right. just gorgeous.
Right. Yeah. Let's get into some of these stories. Chris, let's start with you. Let's start with your house plants.
Okay.
All
that
right?
sounds kind of nefarious, but okay. So I'm on my day off. It's a beautiful Saturday.
Yep.
I'm just tootling around my neighborhood, and for me that means I'm walking around because I don't drive. Mm-hmm. And it was so delightful. Every time I turned a corner, someone I knew from some segment of my life would pull over and say, "Hey, do you need a ride?" This happened 4 times. It was delightful. And I didn't need a ride because I wasn't going anywhere. I was just walking around my neighborhood and I saw this place I'm always intensely curious about. It has the world's longest name. It's called the West Gray Metropolitan Multi-Service Center. You might be familiar with this place. You know, I go there to vote. Some people go there to vote.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, what are the services? What else goes on in there? Right? So I'm walking by. They have a big sign outside, and it says plant sale. And that would not normally resonate with me. I have a 300-square-foot apartment. I do not have a green space. I do not want a green space. And I never wanted a house plant because I already have a cat. And it just sounds like something else that's vulnerable that I need to care for. But this is a good excuse to go nosy around in this building. So I go inside. They have a great room. And in the big room, on the very back tables, there are these huge cactuses. And you can tell someone has poured their life blood into growing these things from a spore or an egg or a weed or a seed, however you make them. But you can tell from the front of the room that these are $85. And that is way over my plant budget, which is zero, because I do not want a plant. But in the front of the room, they have these long tables, and they have these little tiny pots, and they have these little tiny things sticking out of them. Some of them just look like a stick. I mean, there's just hundreds of them. And these ladies are still steady setting them out. So I went up to one of the ladies and I said, "Hey, how much are these?" And the woman took a long look at the other woman. And then she said, "I think we've decided that they're going to be a dollar." And then she told me this story. And after she told me this story, I started crying. I bought 5 plants. And now I'm a member of the organization, which is the Houston Cactus and Succulent Association. And you may say that, wow, that's niche. But in Houston, if you have an interest, there are people out there for you. For example, my friend, in her heart, she is a mermaid. And she has connected with other mermaids, and they talk about mermaid stuff. In Houston, if you have an interest, your people are here. That's why I love this city. So anyway, this is the story she told me. This guy was the president of this organization. He was very well loved in the organization. He was president for a long time. And then he got old, and he's like, "I need to go move with my daughter in Arizona." So he packed up all his plants, because he's a propagator. He had so many plants. He took them all to Arizona, and she built him a huge greenhouse so he could still continue to make these plants, right? So last year, his daughter reached back out to the organization and said, "Hey, I just wanted to let you know that my dad passed away. He really loved being in your organization, and now I have all his plants, and I don't want them. Do you have any idea what would be a good idea to do with them? I don't want to throw them away." And I swear the woman must have put him on hold for like 10 seconds. And then she got back on the line and she said, "We'll be right there." They came and picked every single plant up in their personal vehicles. They got a U-Haul. They brought all 100 of his plants back to Houston. This is the part where I started crying. So, yeah, they brought them back. And the daughter said, "You know, I'd love to just have you sell these plants to raise money for the organization, but my dad would want it to be so that everybody who wanted one of these plants could afford to buy one. That's why they were all a dollar. That's why I bought 5, okay?" And as I was talking to the ladies, they said this was the perfect plant for me because if you take care of it, it'll die. You're supposed to ignore it. It grows in a rock in the desert, right? You just ignore it completely and it grows fine. As a matter of fact, not only am I a new plant mom, I'm a new plant grandma because the thing has already pupped or whatever. It made more of itself in the pot. And then I'm like, "Oh, crap, I need to, like, repot this," right? And I didn't want to just go to Walmart. This is this guy's legacy. He has hybridized these plants. They are his bespoke plants. So I wanted to go to a bougie plant store, right? So I went to the bougie plant store. There's a little young person working the register who had the most tired eyes I had ever seen on a human being. And I walked in there and I started to tell her this story. And she goes, "If you're going to tell me a story, I'm going to have to sit down." So we sat down. I showed her pictures of the plants. I told her the story. I said, "I just feel a really big responsibility to these plants because it's this guy's legacy." And she just looked at me dead in the eyes and said, "I wouldn't worry too much about these plants. Things die. It's nature's way." And I was like, wow, is this girl like a guru? She took off all this stress off of me. Things die. It's nature's way. And then I saw she was playing with her bangs. And while I was recuperating from my broken leg, I watched so many TikToks of people with great hubris going with the scissors to cut their own bangs. And they go in there very confidently. chop, 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 and immediately it's in centimeter from their hairline every single time. It's like great excitement, great regret. This girl had those bangs. And then I'm like, girl, never mind. Just give me the $18 soil. I bought everything. That's my story.
Yeah, it's so good.
All right. You know, one of the things that you do a lot of things so well when you tell stories, Chris, really. But one of the things that you do so well is that you take the simple areas of our surrounding and you make great stories out of them. Doesn't sound really profound, but most people can't do it. You do great stories about dogs, about volleyball, you know, about houseplants. How do you do that?
I have a lot of free time. I'm underemployed.
That's not true.
I'm underemployed. When you're underemployed, you can daydream. You really don't get paid anything at all, so your time is your own.
Let's talk about daydreaming.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have ideas for a story. How do you document them?
I don't. I don't ever do anything with them. I just think about them, and then they leave my mind. And then when the moth topics come up, one good thing about the moth is you go back through your life, and you look for things that resonate with that topic. And that way you can kind of re-experience your life.
Right. And Chris is talking about the moth, which is here in town. It meets the second Tuesday every month at Warehouse Live, the new one in Midtown, and they do themes every month, and that's what you're talking about. And, you know, you're right. You know, those themes really do help us kind of access our experience space, and that's a great way of doing it. But I give you a lot of credit because, you know, documenting stories is something I sometimes have a hard time doing. Do you put them in themes? Do you put them in, you know, chronology? You put them, sometimes I talk about things like things that happen on Mondays or Fridays because that gives me kind of a sense of emotion, tone. They're all different kinds of things. But one of the things that we learned on this show is that everybody is a storyteller. And that's why I ask you these questions, because I always get questions like, you know, Hank, I've got a story to tell, but I'm boring. Okay. Nothing exciting happens in my life. That's a typical question that I get. But you're an example of someone who takes really great stuff that happens during the course of the day, and you find drama in it. And that was my point.
Maybe they just need a plant. They're not boring. They just need a plant.
How come I didn't think about that?
That's it.
They need a house plant.
They do.
You want an exciting life? Yeah. Buy a cactus.
Yes, you need a cactus. They don't even change much.
Right. That's a very pointed topic. Yes, very, very good.
It's a thorny subject.
Thorny subject. Now, talking about the moth. Harwood, you're about to tell a story that was recently on the Moth Story Hour. I love this story. And this was one that in many ways resonates with many people, despite the fact that we may not have experienced exactly the same thing. We're going to talk about that after we hear this wonderful tale.
Sure. So just a little trigger warning. There is mention of suicide in this story. So that's all I wanted to say about that. So I love basketball. I've loved it since I was 13, and I was a St. Anne's Fighting Shamrock. We were the fiercest greenery in all of Houston. I loved basketball into my teens, and I played into my 20s. And in my 30s, I was playing in city parks. And I noticed that the guys and girls that were playing ball, they were much faster and stronger than I was, and I started to get hurt. And I thought, it's time to put the basketball down. So I put it down. Well, 10 years ago, I was 50. I just basically struck gold. I'm at this Miles Davis event. It's a fundraiser. And I asked this guy in the popcorn line, what do you do for fun? He says, I play basketball. I immediately sized this guy up. I'm like, he's 10 years older than me. I said, with who? He says, with a bunch of guys my age, all our kids went to this grade school and we play on their court. Well, in my mind, I'm already playing with them. It's air conditioned. It's full court. It's wooden. I mean, what could be better? I said, you play with a bunch of guys your age. He said, yeah, and older. I said, you know, that's the kind of group I feel like I could be really competitive with. He says, you know, you're welcome to join us anytime. Well, I've been playing with them every week, two times a week, for the last decade, and just having a ball. One thing in basketball is that's very important is communication. It's the difference between having a great team and having an okay team. And without going into semantics, one form of communication is calling out a pick. And usually what that means is it's you hear something like Harwood left. And that means that there's a guy there that's going to be standing there and they're letting me know. Well, I didn't hear that, which means now I'm going full speed and I'm going to run into this guy. So I ran into this guy. He caught me right under my rib cage, pushed all the air out of me. You know, in my 20s, I'd have coughed a little bit. I'd probably shook it off and played another 2 hours or something. They're like, you okay? And I'm like, nope, not okay. Not okay. I'm done that night. I was done that night. I was done for another week. I went to the chiropractor 3 weeks later. Treatment 6 weeks later, I'm back on the court. I'm walking in and I see this new guy and he's sitting by himself. And I thought, I'm going to go say hi to him because when I was new, somebody said hi to me. And as I'm walking over to him, I just noticed he's just got the weight of the world on him. And I thought, wow, that looks like depression. And I know depression. I've fought it myself. And then I finally thought, wow, he's got that don't F with me kind of body language. And for all those reasons, I went over and I said, hey, I'm Harwood. I hadn't seen you before. And he said, well, my name's Steve. And it's not that I haven't been here before. It's just been a long time. My kids went to school here and I used to play with these guys. And I said, great. Well, everything he's saying is super slow and labored. And I'm like, well, what do you do when you're not playing basketball? He says, well, I used to have a business and I sold it. And I'm still trying to lift him up. I'm like, you sold your business. That's a good thing, right? And he said, yeah, it's a good thing. And I said, well, what are you going to do now? He said, that's part of the problem. I really don't know. And I said, well, you're going to play basketball. And he smiles and he said, yeah, tonight I'm going to play basketball. I don't remember anything else about that night. 2 weeks goes by. We get the regular email from Mike, who sends out these emails that says, you know, basically he's telling us there aren't going to be chairs on the basketball court. There's no play. There's no PTA meeting. He says, basketball's on. I'm going to make an announcement. If you could come a little early. So he gathers everybody at half court and he says, I didn't want to send this in an email. He says, Steve committed suicide. He says, I know we're just playing basketball here, but I want you to know you can talk to me if something's going on. And from now on, when I send these emails out, I'm going to let you see everybody's email. We need to be able to reach each other. And it really changed me. Guys that would ask to go have dinner or tea or something after basketball, and I always said no. And now I always say yes. And so I was playing with these guys last night. And one of the things that used to piss me off about these old guys, you know, Mike, he was probably 65 at the time, is that they don't warm up. And I'm like thinking to myself, dudes, you're twice as old as I am. You're going to get hurt. You need to warm up. And they're just shooting the poop. You know, they're just talking. And then I thought, you know what? Maybe that's why they come. And maybe that's the most important part.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. God, you didn't tell us you were going to say shooting the poop, though. That's a pretty, yeah. That is.
I changed that word. It rhymes with it. Yeah.
You know, I've heard you tell that story before. And every time you tell that story, I've just heard you really tell two or maybe three times. You revisit it in your mind, don't you?
I do. Yeah.
What are you thinking about when you're telling that story tonight?
I'm thinking about, I've known a lot of people that have committed suicide, and not a lot, but I think maybe more than most people, and I think it's more common than people know. I also learned from The Moth that when they did it on the national broadcast, they made an announcement that said that you can dial 899, I believe, which is the national suicide hotline. So if you have a problem and you need help, ask for help.
Right.
My hope in telling this story is that, you know, maybe some men, and I know women have a hard time asking for help too, will ask for help or offer help to somebody that doesn't, you know, that doesn't look like they're okay. And I don't do it all the time, but I'm glad I at least tried that night.
Well, you and I talked about this, and this is a great story about resonating, because, you know, people think that when a story resonates, you have to experience exactly the same thing as what is in that story, and that's not true. You know, resonating means that whatever story you tell somehow inspires a memory, inspires a thought, a lesson, a parable, if you will. And this one, I think, is a great example because, you know, there are so many times, and all of us can relate to this, my God. If you drive in this city, you know that there are times that you like to gesture, right, to various people who do strange things to you as you're driving on the road. And you think to yourself, you know, F you, you know, you're flip. And you, sometimes you have to think to yourself, you know, yeah, you know, these are real a-holes at the time. These are people who are kind of pissing you off. But you know what? Maybe they're going through something that day. You don't know what it is. Nobody knows what's happening behind the proverbial closed doors. But you don't know what's happening in their life, is my point. And I've been here because I've done this to people. And then when I've gotten out of a car, they will literally say to me, you know, you have no idea what I did today. And of course, I back off and I say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to offend you, yada, yada. But you know what? You know, my mother died, or I had a bad breakup, or things that happened to any one of us during the course of the day. Nothing really profound, but something that really changes us. We appear angry, we're frustrated, we're pissed off. We've all been there. And I'm not suggesting that everybody who does crazy things to us deserves a break. That's not what I'm saying. But sometimes we read things differently, and we don't know what's happening in a person's life. And I think that one of the things that I've learned from this really great story is that sometimes you just take a deep breath, you back off and back up. Just take it easy for a moment. Just take a deep breath. Don't react. Respond, but just don't react. And again, that seems like really simple stuff, but to me, I think it's really important. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it resonates, because it's something that we can all learn from.
Yep.
Right? Rico, what do you think? You think, and I know.
Yeah, pretty much, right? No, it's just powerful to hear how common, you know, this suicide topic is now versus before.
Yeah, why is that, you think?
I would like to hope that it's because we've all become more compassionate, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Well, yeah, you know, Rico, not only a great engineer, he was a student of mine, took storytelling, took the radio class as well. And you know, stories really do stretch the boundaries of the human heart. I talk about that all the time. And that's one of the reasons why this show has lasted so long. We've been on since 2008. It's kind of funny. When I was on in 2008, I was a guest on a show called Open Journal. We still have it, sort of a catch-all. And I was talking about storytelling. And then the day after, Ernesto Aguilar, who was the program manager at the time, called me and said, Hank, you know, you did a pretty good job yesterday, and the person who hosted the show quit. And I said, because of me? Well, he says, no, you know, she's leaving, and we need a spot. Would you be interested in hosting? I said, sure, you know, sure. And what do you want me to do? He says, well, you can do anything you want, really. I said, well, would you mind if I sort of took the model that was very big at the time, which was, you know, An American Life, you remember that show, storytelling, and try that, because we've got some really great storytellers in town. And I'd love it if we can have them come through these studios and tell some really great tales. He says, well, it's a good idea. I'm not so sure our community will get into it, but give it a try. And that was in 2008. And this is the honest to God truth. We did it for a month, and we got calls. A lot of calls saying, you know, I don't know what Hank's doing. Can we do that every week? Because I was doing it once a month. And wow. After 2 months, we got a lot of calls. People loved it. And then we went weekly. And this community has been extraordinarily supportive. And that is, I'm not trying to be hyperbolic here. I'm not trying to exaggerate. It's because of you, everyone, that this show has worked. And that is the reason why I'm going to ask with great confidence and even more conviction that you give us a call at 713-526-5738, option one. And we'd like you to please, please donate what you can. I know things are tough. I really do. But whatever you can donate would be great. And if you could become a sustaining member, so much the better. You want to give $5 a month? That's cool. You know why? Because the more sustaining members we have, the fewer fund drives we're going to have, because we won't need them. We're going to be able to count on this money every month. We are listener sponsored. We have no choice but to ask for your support, right? Rico, this station's been pretty good to you, huh?
Sure has.
What do you want to say about it?
It's given me something to do. No.
Thank you.
Right.
Yeah. Same here.
This station takes juvenile delinquents and they give them something to do.
There you go.
Now,
exactly.
But you've learned a lot, right?
I have, and that's part of the reason I stay. If not for the technology, it's for the stories that I hear, not just on this show, but all the people who work in the background of it, you know?
Right. Yeah. Please give us a call. 713-526-5738, option one. Speaking of juvenile delinquency, yep. Right? Harwood, you got a story about the blimp trap?
Yes.
All right. This is great. Yeah. Let's go.
Well, when I was, 9 years old, 13 years old, anyway, some age around grade school, my best friend Bill was a special needs guy, and that's only important because later his unbridled enthusiasm was really cool to witness, and you'll understand in a minute. So we were obsessed with two things, the Goodyear blimp and football, and not in any specific order because they were both kind of magical to us. We lived a block north of Rice Stadium. And what that meant is every Saturday during football season, we got both. Because at that time, this was in the early 70s, I suppose, the blimp would come and visit the Rice University football games and, I guess, you know, sell advertising over the fans. And it would loop around our neighborhood and then loop back. And so what we would do, Bill was an amazing athlete, but he didn't communicate in a traditional way because he had special needs. But because I've known him since zero, I could speak Bill. I could speak his language. And so I always picked him on my team, and he could throw the ball a mile and so forth. Anyway, what also would happen is whenever there weren't kids around, we never played one-on-one. We were always on the same team. And how do you do that? Well, Bill invented this game that we would play the ghosts. And the way that works is we would hear the announcers over at Rice University call out, you know, and number 55, you know, scores a touchdown. And those are the fans going nuts and so forth. And and Bill would act this out. And then I caught on very quickly. You know, I'd hike the ball and then we'd listen and it would say, tackled on the 45-yard line. And, you know, and we'd throw ourselves into a bush because one of the imaginary ghost players had tackled us. Anyway, it was hilarious. Well, inevitably, this would happen. We'd hear, you know what that is?
The blimp.
See, Chris has heard this story. That sound is the sound, the rumble of the blimp coming in the sky over these giant live oak trees. And we'd look up in the sky and, you know, very shortly after we started hearing that sound, it would come floating by. And it was just magical. You know, we'd get on our bikes, we'd cross Rice University, which on a game day is a busy street, and our parents would have killed us, but we had to because there was a balloon going by with humans inside, and it was magic. I mean, you had to go see what was going to happen with this thing. And we just imagined, like, what would it be like to be inside that and so forth. We bought posters. We had little models of the blimp. And then one day I said, Bill, we need to make a blimp trap. And he was totally all in. And yes, you heard it right, a trap. An enormous trap from our imagination for the blimp. So you need very specific things to make a blimp trap. You need a dad that has unfinished projects in the garage, which basically were four boards the size and shape of a rectangle that would fit two small boys. You need old rusty handlebars from an old bike that we stuck into the dirt. You need grabbers because you got to grab the blimp, right? And those were dead pecan tree limbs that kind of looked like hands, you know. And so he would sit in the back with the grabbers, and I would sit in the front and drive the blimp. And then we made up all these words, you know, like, you know, engage the flim flam, you know, and make sounds and so forth. And then, you know, engage the grabbers, and here comes the blimp, you know, and whatever we would say. And so we almost caught the blimp because it would circle over the neighborhood and then go back to the football team and then circle over the neighborhood. And we just, like, you know, very close to catching it a lot. Well, my dad's a writer, a freelance writer for all the papers in town. He's at the press club. He's introduced to the guy that manages the blimp hangar. The Goodyear blimp used to be stationed on the north side of town where you know, the Woodlands is now. It was just nothing, a giant field with a giant, you know, hangar that said Goodyear on the side. And he said, you know, I feel like I should warn you, give you my card, because my son and his best friend have a blimp trap. The guy says, I'm sorry, a blimp trap? He says, yes. If the blimp ever goes missing, it's likely in our driveway. And he says, really? Well, if you give me, you send me a photograph of the blimp trap, I'll get them a ride on the blimp. So my dad didn't tell us about this because maybe the guy doesn't follow through or something. But he did take a picture. He did send it in. The guy sent back three tickets for me, Bill, and Bill's mom. I'll never forget it, man. We get there. There's an observation room, giant glass wall. The driver of the blimp must have known because it was seemed like it was right around the time Star Wars came out or whatever. But he came right over the top of that glass wall, and it just kept coming and coming, and it was loud, and it was bull. You know, it got louder and louder. And I was scared. I was like, I don't know if I want to get in that thing. But anyway, these guys grabbed these ropes on the nose of the blimp, and we all hoisted up inside. We all got to drive the blimp that day. I have this really funny memory, and I'm not sure if I made it up or if it's true, but I remember Bill, there was a thing in the middle of the two front seats that made the blimp go up and down, and you kind of, you know, controlled it very carefully. And while he was driving the blimp, because the pilot let us both drive, he spun that thing. And if it had been like a, you know, a fighter jet, it would have just, we would have all died. But it's a blimp, and it's slow and lumbering, and so the nose starts to go a little lower, and the captain's like, okay, son, I'll take it from here, thank you, and pulls it back. So that's the story. Don't think about it for 25 years. I'm in the gallery where I work, and this couple comes in. They're like, coolest thing this weekend, we got to, we were in Atlanta, and the Goodyear blimp is, you know, stationed there, and we both got to ride in it. So I told him what I just told you, and then I got tickled, and I couldn't stop laughing, and the guy's looking at me kind of strange. He says, what's so funny? And I said, well, I just hadn't thought about that in 25 years, and I'm just realizing now that when I was 9 years old, my best friend and I made a blimp trap, and it worked. And so that's not just the end of the story. The follow-up to that story is that I played it for a friend because I told it to the Moth, and I played it, you know, from my phone, and my friend heard it, and he's like, you know what? I want to make a movie about that. So we got some investors to listen to the story, and they were charmed by it. And Sean Welling made – Welling Films made a movie called The Blimp Trap, and you can – I think you can watch it on Vimeo.
That's amazing.
Isn't it?
That is amazing. The Blimp Trap. Yeah. You told that at Wimberley, didn't you?
I think so. Yeah, that's right. That's right. The Wimberley Storytelling Festival. That's right.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Listen, I want to thank Catherine Kay and Sheena S. from Houston. Sheena is a sustainer. Thank you, you guys, so, so much. You know, they are the two of the next 67 people who will be calling any minute now. Right, Rico? To give us a call. 713-526-5738, option one, or go to kpft.org. Go ahead to donations, and if you would please, scroll to So What's Your Story as one of those shows that you would love to see on the air. What do you want to add? Rico, what kind of goodies do we have online for people who pay thousands?
For thousands? I don't know, maybe.
A mug. Yeah, a mug,
some coffee beans. We've got shirts. We've got brand new designs. I've taken part in some of them. We've got.
You've designed some of the stuff?
Some of them, but it's not
money?
About me. No. Oh, okay. No, all of the proceeds go straight to KPFT for transmitter fees, our yearly licenses for music,
right.
As well as our one full-time employee. So your thousand metaphorical dollars goes a long way.
Well, you're right. Look, we're not paid. Real seriously, we're not. And we spend a lot of time doing this. I spend, honest to God, 4 to 6 hours a week. And that's not much. And you guys know that. You've been here a long time. And I really do. And it's worth every penny. It really is. But, you know, nobody calls in and says, it's a lousy show. What do you expect from a bunch of people who aren't paid? Right? I mean, we don't do that. We try to bring you quality stuff. And we do it all the time. And did I ever tell you guys a story about the 94-year-old guy who had an affair with two married women? Did I tell you that?
No, maybe.
Well, it's really a treat because, you know, Sheena called and Catherine. I always tell a little story just as a special treat. You're going to want to pay for this. So, you know, this guy has an affair with two women, and he goes to the priest, and he says, Father, forgive me, I have sinned. Well, what have you done, my son? Well, I haven't been here for a long time. It's been so many years since I've been at confession, but I have something to confess. He says, I'm 94 years old, and I had an affair with two married women last week. And the priest says, well, why are you telling me? He says, hell, I'm telling everybody. This is Hank Rubichak. Yeah, and you're listening, too. So, what's your story with my guest storytellers, Chris Gorman and Harwood Taylor? Only on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. Anybody else calling in nowadays? No? They are calling in? Somebody else is calling in? No? Well, you know what? I just want everybody to know. It's really sad if you tuned in and you heard... That's right. Silence. We don't want that to happen. 713-526-5738. A real quick call out to our wonderful sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. Also wanted to let you know that for those of you who want to crank up your storytelling skills or really find out what's happening in the state, the Tejas Storytelling Association has its annual festival March 7th through 10th in Denton at the Denton Civic Center. So just wanted to call out there because you will love it. It is not expensive. We can't talk costs, but you're not going to have to go into your retirement distribution to pay for it. Chris, you've got another personal narrative, but this one is inspired by Alana, Jolie Abbott's Once a Queen. Now, I looked her up a little bit, and if I'm not mistaken, she's an editor, a proofreader, author, and a game designer, so creating interactive novels really makes good sense. So tell us the story.
Well, I was talking to my friend Mary Carroll, and we were talking about how the future always looks kind of dirty, and people look sad, the people look hungry. I had just seen the Hunger Games sequel. And I was just thinking, why does the future have to be bad? And we were talking about it, and I think what we need to do is imagine a future where things are great, because how can we have a future where everything is better if we can't even picture it in our mind or imagine it, right? So I was looking around for some stories to read, and I found this book, and it's an anthology, and it's called Never Too Old to Save the World. And I like the idea of that, like... It always seems like if there's a person who's going to save everything, it's always a little baby. It's a kid, right? Well, what about us? We know how to do stuff, right? So this is not a personal narrative. This is my adaptation of this woman's short story, and it's called Once a Queen, okay? And so Susie is packing a backpack for her niece. She is going to take her niece to the same summer camp she went to when she was her niece's age, when she was 11. So she's looking at the items in the backpack, and she's like, should I take sunscreen? Yeah, probably. She was thinking about the things she wished she had when she was at camp, like long pants or pants with pockets even. And she's like, should I put in a first aid kit? And then she thought, well, I hope she doesn't get into trouble right away, so I'm just going to put in a small pack of Band-Aids. And she's like, Claire, could you hurry up? It's about time for us to leave for camp. And Claire sticks her head around the door and says, Aunt Suze, can I just take my phone? And she says, no, Claire, you're not going to have time to use your phone. You're going to be really busy. Did you see the compass I was going to put in your backpack? She goes, I have a compass. Auntie, it's on my phone. And she said, Aunt Claire says, hey, there's no reception up there anyway. You don't need your phone. And her niece says, are you really going to take me to the same summer camp that you went to when you were 11? And she's like, that's what I told your mom. And that's even the truth. Okay, so when Susie was 11, she went to summer camp at this camp called Camp Totoket, and she met her two best friends. They were in the same cabin at camp. They did everything together. They learned how to paddle a boat, how to tie knots, and they did everything together. So one day they were on their way to archery practice. They had their bows and arrows, and all of a sudden there was this shimmer in the sky, and a portal opened. And if you don't know what a portal is, it is a door to another world. And so they were just sucked through the portal, and they were in the snow. They were on a tundra, and they heard this, woo, it was the winter wolves. And fortunately, the girls had their archery equipment, and they weren't scared. They just slayed those wolves. They took them out, okay? And then the people that were in the forest, the people that lived in this world called Altifair, they all ran out and said, "The queens, the triune queens have slain the winter wolves. Spring is here." They were pumped, right? So as soon as that happened, when the celebrating started, the portal opened again and they were sucked back to camp. And then they had to explain to the camp nurse why they had frostbite in the summer. So for the rest of the week at camp, they were hanging out together. They made sure that they were always ready for when that portal opened. So people thought they were nuts. They wore their long pants, they wore their long sleeves, they had their backpacks, and they were ready to go back to this world. And then all this time passed, it was the last day of camp, and they're like, "I guess, you know, maybe we imagined it, maybe it wasn't real." And then all of a sudden, there was a shimmer in the sky, this portal opened. And they went back through to Altifair, and instead of being in the tundra, they were in the palace. And everybody knew that they were the triune queens. They were like, "These are our queens." They were in a parade. The parade is going on. Spring is here. People were pumped again. Okay, so they were enjoying being queens. You know, they were set off to battle. They battled dragons. They battled more wolves. You know, they were in front of the charge. They were leading the charge. And as they grew up, their duties started to change. It wasn't so much about battling things. It was more about diplomacy. They had to get the Nortalians to talk to the Catalonians. They needed peace in the land. And Susie would go into the city and talk to her friend Constantine the Elf. She would sit with him in his library, and she'd say, "Constantine, I wish we were just killing things. It was really easier than all this diplomacy. I'm so tired of trying to make people be friends that won't be friends, all this talking." He said, "Yeah, that is difficult. It is hard to convince people to be friends." And she said, "You know, when I was a little kid, I was so cute. People just did whatever I said. But now I'm growing up and people don't find me as cute anymore. You know, they don't listen to me. It's hard to even just make friends with people now that I'm getting older." And he said, "You know, when you are older, you do have to make an effort to be friends with people. It's not instant. People don't think you're cute anymore, you know? Just hang in there. Keep working at it, right?" So the queens were growing up, and as soon as they hit their 21st birthday, there was a shimmer in the sky, and instantly they were pulled back through the portal. Guess where they were? At camp, and they were 11. So they had to go back to Earth as 11-year-olds, after they'd been queens in another world. If you can imagine going to middle school and having to endure middle school when you used to be royalty, that's a tough one, okay? I remember Susie would always say, "I don't have detention, I'm a queen." So they started to grow up again, right? And she knew that Louisa and Janae, her friends, had something between them. It did not surprise her when they got married. And when she was bridesmaids on both of their sides, she went to the florist and she bought flower crowns that reminded them so much of the crowns they used to wear in Altifair. So Louisa was a travel photographer. She was always off taking pictures. Of course, Janae was with her. Susie just got a job at a bookstore. And she just felt like she was kind of stuck, you know, like life had passed her by, until her niece was born. Claire listened to every story she had to tell about Altifair. She believed it wholeheartedly. She was like, "I can't wait till I'm 11 and I can go to camp and I can go to Altifair." She's like, "Susie, Aunt Susie, will you come with me?" She goes, "No, I'm too old. The portal doesn't work for adults. It only works for kids." So as soon as she turned 11, she took her niece back to camp and they were waiting. And nothing happened. And she was like, "Well, maybe it wasn't true. You know, it's a cute story you told me, Aunt Susie, but it's not really." And then there was a shimmer in the sky. And then this portal opened up. And instead of being sucked through back to Altifair, Constantine stepped out, her friend from Altifair. And he said, "You know, I've done some work on the portal. It doesn't have to be a child anymore. In fact, I see that you have a niece, and she is the right age, and we would welcome another queen, but really, we're here for you. You know how Altifair works. You know the Nortalians and the Catalonians. You've killed wolves. You've killed dragons. We need someone with experience. Can you call the other queens?" And Susie just looked blankly, and Claire said, "I can text them on my phone." She's like, you didn't bring your phone. She goes, I have my phone right here. I'll text them. They're in San Paulo. They can be here in a week. Constantine is like, I can keep the portal stable until all the queens are here. But it's urgent. This is an emergent situation. We need our leadership now. So Susie just put her hand in Constantine's hand and grabbed her niece's hand and said, Constantine, take me home.
Yay.
Wow. When was that story written?
I have no clue. Yeah. I have no idea.
Well, you know, yesterday. Well, there are people that I know who take stories and, you know, they make them into personal narratives after adapting them. But you do that brilliantly because you really own that story. There's no way that I would have known that was an adaptation.
Well, I was at work and we were having let's call it a stressful day at work. There's probably a more colorful way I could describe that. We were having a stressful day at work, and I turned to my coworker and I said, just remember, in another land, you're probably a queen.
That's nice.
That got us through till lunch.
Yeah. Guys, this is what you're paying for. You're paying for great storytelling. You are great for, you know, while I'm sitting here, I can't help thinking about some of the incredible stories that we've heard over the years. There was a woman in 2010 who, for the very first time, talked about her daughter being murdered in Detroit, and she revealed that story on the air. You can imagine how, I mean, it was just unbelievable. Anthony Graves learned about his release on this show, and it just goes on and on. The incredible stories that we've heard, over 700 of them, over 700. Harwood, you know, this is, I don't know if you'd call this your signature story, but it's one that I think of when I think of you. It's the one about your dad's hands, and it's one that I frequently play when we do, you know, some of the better stories of the past. And, well, Rico, let's hear that story.
When I was little, I always remember loving my father's hands. He was a journalist. He wrote for both papers, the old Houston Press and then the Chronicle and the Post. And this was back 60s and the 70s. And I remember him typing all the time and just watching his hands on the, you know, the stacked keys and the tick, 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 zzz, ding, zzz, ding. I mean, I grew up with that sound. It was constant. And then he was a sculptor. He was an amazing draftsman, watching his hands in clay and, you know, watching him push the charcoal around to shade a drawing. There was a grace about his hands that I just loved. He was also bipolar, and he was undiagnosed until I was 7. And so he could be the most incredibly creative and gentle and kind person, and then in the next moment, unwittingly cruel. And, you know, there was no terrible incident. It was more like emotionally just didn't know where I stood with him. And that it continued as an adult. I loved him very much, but I was never really comfortable with him. So when he was 82, he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And I had decided maybe 10 years prior that every Sunday I was going to take him to breakfast. And to let you know how great our family relationships were, my two sisters didn't talk to him for the last 15 years plus of his life. Now, my sister said, why do you do that? You know, and I said, well, it's my service work. And I really meant it. At the time, it was that hard to go to breakfast with him. But I also loved him, and he was charming. And when he was on, he was so on, and he could be so kind and so thoughtful. And so, anyway, confusing relationship. When he got Alzheimer's, you know, of course, I read everything on the internet. I went to the Alzheimer's Association. And great organization, by the way, incredibly helpful to us. They would put us in two classrooms, the patients in one and the caregivers in the other. And it just, you know, forced us or gave us the opportunity to get closer than we'd ever gotten before. And I guess the threat of thinking that one day he might look at me and not know who I was enough fear for me to be more vulnerable, and I got really close to him. One day, I'm taking him to our Sunday obligatory breakfast, and it's not obligatory anymore. I want to be with him now because I know that time's, you know, maybe short. I look down and I see his 82-year-old hand on the center console, and I think I want to hold my father's hand. Just a nice thought, you know, and I'm driving and I think, well, I can't do that. He's, you know, I'm driving. And so then we stopped at a light, red light, and I looked down to hold his hand and I couldn't do it. I was so scared. It was the scariest. I mean, my heart right now beats a little faster even when I tell this story. It was, and I felt, you know, guilty and ashamed. I'm like, this is my 82-year-old father, and I've done all this men's work, and I've done therapy for years, and I can't hold my dad's hand. Well, saved by the green light. So we proceed down the street, stopped at another light, and I thought, I want to hold my father's hand. You know, and there it is. It's just, and I can't do it. And I get emotional when I think about this. But anyway, light turned green again, and we turned onto Heights Boulevard. And I remember we stopped at a stop sign, and there was a woman sitting on a bench waiting. And I felt like I was on stage. And I looked at his hand, you know, this beautiful 82-year-old hand, and I just took my hand off the steering wheel. And it was only a few inches to touch his hand, but it felt like I was... my foot had just left the platform of a bungee jump or something. It was the scariest thing I ever did. And the moment I touched his hand, his other hand came over and covered my hand. Hmm. And it was like he'd been waiting for me to do that. You know, it was just incredible. And it was also so comfortable. It was like we had been practicing it forever. And so for the last year of my father's life, whenever we drove anywhere, we held hands.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, it's like a great movie, you know. You have to keep watching it. It's What would the world be like without stories? I mean, storytelling is important to both of you guys, I know. But there was a time you didn't tell stories, okay? So when you think about what this whole art form has done for you, how do you even put that in words?
Well, I would say what Chris said earlier about just personal narratives, like the moth, you know, having us scan our lives because of a subject makes you remember things because they're important. And that story still chokes me up. I mean, it's not a story. It's my life, you know. And I want to thank you because I had prepared that story for multiple moth subjects. There was love. There was Father's Day. And I kept thinking, this is the perfect story. And they didn't call my name because it's just random. They draw names.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, great, I got this terrific story, and no one's ever going to hear it. And then y'all invited me on the show, and I said, can I tell this story about my dad? And you're like, you can tell whatever you want. And so thank you for doing this program because, you know, hopefully somebody will take an emotional risk because those are the hardest ones to take, I think.
Well, I think that's one of the things that really does serve as the greatest common denominator in storytelling. We're all vulnerable, you know, on one level or another. And I think the idea is that when we find that vulnerability, you know, we can't get enough of it because it really does connect that human soul. We let each other in. What about you, Chris? What do you think? Because I know there was a time you didn't tell stories, but you're a great storyteller, my God. And, you know, what has it done to you?
I want to give an honorable mention to lying because I think that's one of the earliest forms of storytelling that I can remember.
We like to call it mild exaggeration, but go for it. No, that's all right. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's just, you know, just saying. You got to be creative. If you're trying to get out of trouble, sometimes you got to make something up.
Right.
Been there.
Right.
Just saying.
Yeah. Well, you know, actually, that's a really good point. And on a more serious point, that's what an apocryphal story is. I mean, I don't know if anybody out there knows this, but I don't want to bust anybody's balloon. But you know, George Washington really didn't chop down a cherry tree. I just... Okay. You guys knew that, right?
That's just his branding. Right. That's branding.
But, you know, the point is that it's not a story about chopping down cherry trees. It's a story about character, about honesty, right?
Sure.
And that's what it is. That's what an apocryphal story does. So, you know, even when you lie, let's just say there's a tiny, tiny bit of truth, a portal of truth. Is that
a pebble?
Maybe just maybe a pebble?
A seed.
A pebble.
Just
all
a
right.
seed.
All right. Well, it takes 90.1 seconds to give us a call, you know, and give us a call at 713-526-5738. Jam KPFT option one. Please do that. Keep us going. Keep us going strong. We are your station. Thank you to Chris Gorman and Harwood Taylor for demonstrating the power of this show and what it brings to our community and throughout the state. Both of you do indeed spotlight the formula for effectively telling any story. Build it with skill, own it with pride, and deliver it with heart. Don't anybody move, not even for a moment, because Living Art with Michael Woodson and Michael Carson, another KPFT exclusive, is coming up. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And be sure to join us every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for So What's Your Story? You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
KPFT Houston, little extended version of our intro music early. Fun drive special. KPFT, yeah. Gotta love KPFT on Caroline Street. Yeah,
wonderful Wednesday night. Great show before ours. Great stories, as
was
always.
Was that heart-wrenching or what? I was shaking from the